Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease. Welcome to another episode of Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and today I am joined by a very smart individual. His name is Dr. Bill Copeland, and he leads the Mitochondrial DNA Replication Group. He is also the Deputy Chief of Laboratory of Molecular Genetics, and both are with the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. So I want to share with our community that talking to him gives me a reassurance that there are eyes on the mutations that many of us have. And this is so important. His work goes into so much of, you know, the research and development of what we're all hoping for. So welcome, Dr. Copeland. It's so nice to have you on the podcast.
Thank you, Marcy. It's a very much a pleasure to be here.
Awesome. Well, we are looking forward to hearing your story. I think, you know, for you to share your journey as a scientist would be kind of cool. Can you tell us how you got your start?
Oh, wow. That probably goes back to when I was a kid. You know, my father was in the military, so I didn't have a lot of science exposure through that. And my mother was a music teacher, but my grandmother was in healthcare and she wanted me to be a physician. And so she would buy, you know, this was growing up in the 60s and 70s, she would buy me scientific models, like models of the organs, models of the eye. And that kind of got me a start to just thinking about that. And then I just kind of, from there, it was just a natural curiosity about how nature works.
Oh, wow. So while some kids had models of cars and action figures, you had models of the eye. But I'm glad she bought those for you because it led you to a career that is so important to everyone listening. How did you specifically get into the world of mitochondrial disease?
That started when I was a postdoctoral fellow at Stanford University. I was studying with Teresa Wong, who was studying nuclear DNA polymerases and how they copy our nuclear DNA. And specifically, I was looking at this one polymerase called a polymerase alpha. Polymerase, I mean, is the machinery that copies our DNA. And it was in the late 80s that the field in general was getting very interested in these anti-age drugs, such as AZT and some dioxys and some of the very early ones you've heard of, because soon after they were approved, the population using these drugs started to get a toxicity. And they didn't know why, but they knew they were nucleotide precursors. That means they were building blocks of DNA that were altered as an antiviral. So by definition, they should inhibit a polymerase, a DNA polymerase. And they were designed to inhibit the HIV reverse transcriptase, which is a polymerase that copies RNA into DNA. But so we started looking at the effect on the nuclear DNA polymerases, and it was sort of modest and it really wasn't that significant. But about that same time, researchers at the National Cancer Institute identified that the cellular target looked like it was a mitochondria, because these HIV infected patients taking the drugs were developing muscle myopathy, peripheral neuropathy, and that kind of pointed the toxicity to the mitochondrium. And so at Stanford also, I was next to a laboratory, David Clayton, who was one of the founding fathers of mitochondrial DNA replication. And so in sort of in a casual collaboration with some of his people, we started looking at the effect of the yeast mitochondria and the effect of these toxicities of these drugs. And they did indeed look like they were affecting the mitochondria. So it was about that time when I wanted to start my own group. And I was looking for jobs throughout the U.S. And I landed this job at where I am now at the National Institutes of Environmental Health, scientist. But we specifically wanted to ask, you know, what was unique about the mitochondrial DNA polymerase that made it sensitive to these antivirals? And one of the big challenges at the time was that nobody really had a good appreciation of the human mitochondrial polymerase. They knew it existed. It had a name already pre-assigned to it, but nobody had it. And so we went after it with just brute force genetics. And we were able, after a while, we were able to clone the human Pol Gamma, which was what we know now, the human mitochondrial DNA polymerase, the gene for it, which is called Pol G. And so that was published in 1996. And from there, we were able to overproduce the protein and start studying it with these effect of these antivirals. And in fact, we now know why the Pol G is sensitive to many of these antivirals, because it is actually very similar in nature to some of the bacterial polymerases and some of the bacterial phage-like or viral polymerases. And that is why it's sensitive to that, because of this ancestry of the mitochondria is somewhat similar to bacterial-like proteins, is that's why it's sensitive. So we were on a journey just to characterize this inhibition and toxicity using biochemistry and structural biology, when in 2001, the first report of a genetic linkage of a mitochondrial disease to the gene Pol G was established by this gentleman, Gert van Gotham, published in, I believe, Nature Genetics. And what was really interesting about that is he identified several mutations, but in one family, it was a dominant mutation, this Y955C, that's tyrosine at position 955, and the Pol G gene was mutated to a cysteine amino acid. What was curious at the time for us is that we already had that mutation, because we knew that that mutation, we were studying this mutation anyway, because we knew that one affected the antiviral nucleotide selection. And so we were poised to study the effect of these disease-causing mutations. And we've done that ever since. And so we started a journey to look at disease mutations in the Pol G. Following that initial report, we and others in the field started identifying many patients with the Pol G mutations. And about 2003, it got so much, I said, look, I can't organize this very well. I need to just establish a website, because there's just too many mutations. And that's when the mutations were like 30 or 40. And now we know there's like 350 disease-causing mutations in the gene for Pol G. And so our website is still going. There's a lot of other compatible or similar type websites that have much detailed information, but we think ours is appeals more to the clinicians and family.
You've done a lot. I don't think I could say what you said back to you, but I know how important it is, and I could follow what you're saying. So can we break down really what mitochondrial disease replication is?
Sure. All right. So we've all heard of, you know, we know the mitochondria are the powerhouse of the cell. We've all heard that.
Yes.
And we've also heard that they carry their own piece of DNA. And that piece of DNA is essential for life. It really only codes for 13 proteins that form with nuclear counterparts to form the electron transport chain. And that's the latter steps of the energy production. But the majority of the proteins that are functioning in the mitochondria are encoded by the nuclear genome. And they make proteins, and those proteins are imported into the mitochondria. Some of those proteins, a fraction of those nuclear proteins, are involved in maintaining and replicating that piece of DNA, that mitochondrial DNA, or what you call mitochondrial genome. That's what we study. We study the actual genes, gene products, the proteins and enzymes that copy and maintain our mitochondrial DNA. So the concept's a little tricky when you're talking about mutations in the mitochondrial DNA that are a result of a gene mutation in the nucleus. And that's because, you know, people don't think, even experts in the field don't understand, like, well, you've got one mutation causing mutations in a different system. And so we're in the Pol G diseases that we study and some of the other proteins we study, what's happening is that that gene mutation is making a dysfunctional Pol G polymerase. And that then gets imported into the mitochondrial, and it can have a severe effect on the replicating of the mitochondrial genome. It can either not work at all, and that would cause depletion of our mitochondrial DNA up to a point where the cells can no longer make ATP. A not so lethal effect would be the one that doesn't cause depletion, but it actually causes mutations in the genome. And those mutations can either be a point mutation, meaning it changes a G to an A or a T to a C, thymine to a cysteine. And we see about a lot of those. But another more catastrophic type of mutation is a deletion. And we know this happens a lot in the adult onset Pol G diseases, is that the defective polymerase causes large deletions within our genome. And those are rather catastrophic because we've also may have heard that in the mitochondria, you have multiple copies of our DNA. And that's a good thing because that offers a buffer from damage. So when you have like a single point mutation, it's not so lethal as long as you've got several other copies that don't have that mutation. The problem with deletion is that it takes out so much of the DNA that genome pretty much is just non-functional. And it's more catastrophic. It just takes out more of our coding region.
My guess is I could be wrong, but most people with mitochondrial disease that are suffering are part of that latter group that you just described. A single point mutation. Would someone that I'm working with through MitoAction, you know, as a patient, could they have a single point mutation? And
you're talking about in the mitochondrial DNA.
Yeah.
Yes. And so when it becomes a problem is, you probably heard the term heteroplasmy.
Mm-hmm.
That's the percent of mutant copies relative to wild copies. So if you have 100 copies of your mitochondrial DNA.
In total, yeah.
And you say 30% have this point mutation, you're okay, because we know there's a threshold,
mm-hmm.
and that threshold is pretty high. It's actually well above 60%. And so 60% of our genomes really have to be affected. But where point mutations happen is that, yes, we all have low levels of certain point mutations, but as long as we have some good copies, then the good copies will complement that point mutation.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as it's below that 60% level. And that could be many mutations, and we get this, what we call intergenomic complementation, when you have a lot of point mutations. And we don't really see that in a disease state. We see that in sort of a mutator model system, where you can just have lots of point mutations.
Oh.
That's, of course, sort of artificial.
But yeah.
It very well tolerates these point mutations, but it does not tolerate
the deletions. Okay.
Because they just take out too much of the DNA.
So the people that I'm conversing with that are really struggling with mitochondrial disease, we all are of that group, most likely.
Probably. Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, if they're Pol G related or some of the other genes involved in maintenance of their DNA, and they're adults, they're most likely have a significant level of these deletions.
Your work is fascinating. I'm so interested by what you do and how you've made such strides in this field. I also understand that you developed a technique to detect the mitochondrial DNA deletions. Can you
Correct.
Explain the technique and what you're learning about deletions in the mitochondrial DNA?
Sure. So we probably all heard about next generation sequencing and whole genome sequencing and such, and that has been very effective. But the when it comes to detecting deletions, there's a what we call sensitivity problem, meaning that the amount, even though our mitochondrial DNA is essential, the actual amount in terms of mass of mitochondrial DNA is really small compared to the whole cell, the nuclear DNA. So mitochondrial DNA in, like, for example, in a muscle tissue only represents 0.3% of our total DNA. But again, it's essential for life.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, even though it's 0.3% of our total DNA, you can have several thousand copies of that piece of DNA. So when it comes to detecting a single deletion in a population of 1,000 molecules against a whole cell DNA where 99.7% of the DNA is nuclear DNA, we run into a sensitivity problem because of the, what we call the noise is too much. And that noise is our nuclear DNA. So we developed a technique from using very small, like muscle biopsies from patients, where basically we just get rid of the nuclear DNA and that enriches for our mitochondrial DNA. And we do that by basically digesting the nuclear DNA using specific enzymes that don't affect the mitochondrial DNA. And that's just biotechnology related. But in doing so, we're able to enrich for our mitochondrial DNA several thousand to a million fold. And that allows us to see deletions very sensitive down to, you know, one in a million, one in 100,000 events. And, you know, again, if you get a deletion of a genome, one in 100,000, it doesn't matter. But what we've seen in some of our patients that we studied, I go back to that eye model that I had as a kid, because that eye model had, what was really cool was had those external eye muscles. And when those are defective, it causes this, the disease PEO, progressive external ophthalmoplegia, because those eye muscles get paralyzed. So we studied as a cohort of those patients, and individually they have a lot of deletions. Each deletion, though, is rather rare, but collectively we were seeing in these patients 70% of the mitochondrial DNA carries large deletions, and that's why they have the disease. But each individual deletion is too low to detect by conventional methods, unless you go through our sort of pipeline. So that's one of our contributions that we've done.
Yeah, and so we can use this, looking at the pattern of these deletions, the frequency of the deletion, we can actually use that as a diagnostic tool. So we looked at normals and we looked at disease patients, and there's a clear line of difference. And you can, so somebody who didn't know if they had PEO, for example, came into us and we did this analysis, we'd say, yes or no, you have this disease.
Wow.
Based upon that.
My wheels are turning. So you've really changed the diagnostic process.
Right. So we identified in a small cohort of about 20 normal people and 20 PEO patients, we identified 35 million deletions, of which 470,000 were unique. Prior to this, only a couple hundred to 1,000 deletions had been documented or characterized in the literature. And one study, we identified nearly 500,000 deletions, unique ones.
Wow. Yeah. Huh. So when I was getting diagnosed in, you know, let's say 2008, thereabouts.
Okay. Right.
And my blood work was being sent to labs all over the country. We were chasing potential mutations based on my mom's symptoms.
Okay.
And I hadn't really shown symptoms yet. And so I'm sure that that work was being done in the labs to eventually find my mutation, right?
Right. I think you said,
CPO
in the twinkle.
Yes. Yes.
Right. So the twinkle was discovered the same month as mutations in the Pol G gene in 2001, and people started, of course, running with that. Pol G just turns out to be really a common cause of mitochondrial diseases in general, but twinkle's not too far behind. At 2008, the technology was that people had a small list of genes that were known to cause mitochondrial disease, and Twinkle was one of them. So people would directly sequence the Pol G, the Twinkle gene, and a few others. And we call that panel sequencing.
Okay.
And they still do that today.
Yeah.
Because it's cheaper than whole genome sequencing. Mm-hmm. But you do miss a lot. You got to remember, you know, you miss 99.99% of your whole genome. But if you know what you're looking at, and you find it,
there, then it works. It's very powerful.
Huh.
I think the problem is with kind of these situations where that does not show a mutation. You don't know the cause. You don't know, you know, the cause, genetic cause.
Right.
Unless you go to whole genome sequencing. And even then it may not answer anything.
Rare disease is so baffling, right?
Yes. Yeah.
I'm very intrigued by everything you do. So someone in your position on a day-to-day basis, like, what is your work currently? Like, what do you do?
So I have a team of, right now it's small, of about four PhD postdocs. And so I'm kind of a hands-on person. I try to meet with each person daily to see what's going on with them during the day. We have, you know, weekly group meetings about the progress. And then we'll have meetings with collaborators. We can't work in a silo, so we definitely have to, you know, use our colleagues and collaborators for advice and for getting projects done. And so it's a lot of it's just meeting people and then going through the science. I also review a lot of papers for journals, and so that's just work. and then there's some administrative work, of course, which nobody likes, but
necessary evil.
Right, right.
So if you're working with postdoc students, do they have the same interest or similar interest in mitochondrial disease research that you do?
A lot of them do. They want to work with me because of their interest in what we do.
I wasn't sure if maybe you were matched up and interest. Okay, right. It's more than that.
They apply to me because of they're interested in this research. And so they genuinely are. I try to take them to yearly meetings on the subjects, and they get as motivated as I do when we meet family members and patients and stuff. So it's been very rewarding in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, that element of work is so intriguing, especially for, you know, someone like me who is suffering from the disease. I mean, you're wonderful and you've made such great strides, but imagine if you can teach, you know, if you work with these folks for a couple of years and then you get a new group.
Right. And a lot of our people, you know, half the people about go into industry, but even then some of them are working on mitochondrial related therapies.
Yes.
And that's great too. Yeah, I have a past postdoc who was an assistant or associate professor, and then she discovered an epileptic drug using, you know, zebrafish and a Pol-G model. And so she's got her own company now. She's CEO of a company in Bethesda. And I've got a few assistant professor or associate professors, you know, we're still working in the field. So that's where it's really rewarding, where you see your progeny go on to also work in the field.
That part is so important.
Because that's one of our goals here is training.
Yeah.
The next generation of scientists. Yeah.
Well, by the sounds of it and the way you talk about it, I am sure you are very good at that.
Well, thank you.
And
we'll see.
It seems like you like that part of the job, right?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. Working with the people is the best part.
What do you feel like are some of the unanswered questions related to how these genes work?
A lot of it is probably regulation. For example, so of the population of our mitochondrial genomes, we know that only a small subset gets copied or replicated, but we don't know why. We don't know what happens when some of these mitochondrial genomes are damaged. Do they get digested away, or do they get sequestered from being copied? And so those are things actually we're going at after right now. It's basically the control levels. And there's still some unanswered questions about how it gets regulated. I mean, we know what drives it is the need for ATP. But what decides in the mitochondria that this genome over the next genome, because you've got, you know, 1,000 copies of this genome, what decides which one gets copied? And we don't have an answer to that yet.
Yeah, that seems like a really big unknown, right?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
And then another one is, you know, we also do a lot of structural biology. We were the first to determine the structure of the Twinkle helicase. And what led to was understanding of there was a cluster of these disease-causing mutations, and where they are in the protein is that they were actually occurred between two subunits of the Twinkle helicase touch each other.
And so we understand now that some of these disease mutations disrupt that interaction and weaken it. And that could cause some of the deletions that it's causing later. So we're definitely using structural biology. We're using bioinformatics. And, you know, my training is mostly in biochemistry, but we're definitely doing a lot of human genetics as well.
I know you did an expert series a couple of years ago with MitoAction, and you were very informative and insightful in everything you said there. But a lot has changed for the good since then. So between the expert series and now, can you share with us any discoveries made?
Yeah. So what we've done, and I'll also talk about the field in general. I think since then, that's when we started diving into structural biology. And it's because of that we now have the first structure of the Twinkle helicase with a really good understanding of the consequence of those disease mutations. Another structural biology project that came to success was there's another protein in the mitochondria that works with the replication machinery called this single-stranded DNA binding protein. And we were one of the first with Marnie Falk in 2019 to identify the first disease-causing mutations in that gene. And several groups also published in 2019. But 2 years ago, well, it's a year and a half ago, postdoc Amanda Riccio solved the structure of this protein, the single-strand DNA binding protein, with DNA bound to it. And that was a first. And that also immediately illustrated how these disease-causing mutations are affecting the function of this protein, either by binding DNA or assembly. And so that's been really rewarding.
Wow.
In the field in general, a lot of us are going after what we call small molecule inhibitors or modulators that can help or such on mitochondrial DNA replication. And my colleague Maria Falkenberg in Sweden has been working with this pharmaceutical company, Pressel, and they have developed a small molecule that helps to rescue some of the unstable disease-causing Pol G enzymes. And it does so by it stabilizes the interaction with the accessory subunit, and that helps to improve the function of mutant variants. And that's looks like it's very promising, and hopefully it'll go to clinical trials.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So there's the one thing that I've seen over the last 10 years is just a flood of the new drug discoveries. I mean, some of them are still early in the pipeline, but there's a lot of promise coming down the pipeline.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad that you think it seems promising. Mm-hmm. I need to hear that more often, right? From the patient perspective. But the work you're doing is so pivotal for me and my family and everyone listening. And as I said earlier in the episode, I don't know that I could replicate some of what you said, but I very much understood it as you were taking us through. And it is really interesting. These are the things that obviously, you know, it's like the behind the scenes work that we don't, from the patient perspective, hear about very often, you know, and I was never that great in science class. So I feel really honored to be able to, you know, meet with people like you who are doing so much for this, you know, very rare disease that I'm dealing with and that everyone listening is either dealing with or someone they love is. And for you to break it down for us has been so kind. I have one more question to ask you. You know, a lot of your work, as I said, is very behind the scenes, and I think you would agree. But what is it like for you when you meet a patient that your work affects?
That is some of the most rewarding parts of this work. So, you know, scientists are fairly self-motivated. They like to get into their project and stuff. But when we meet a patient, it actually provides the real purpose for what we do. And that just makes us want to work harder. Because, you know, we see the effect, we can see some real change. And so the best thing about meeting patients is it's just motivating and rewarding. And it's just too, we learn about the consequences of these, the disease a lot, on a personal level. And mm-hmm. that's really important. Mm-hmm. We don't want to work in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. We want to engage with patients and families.
Well, I really appreciate all that you're doing on an everyday basis and the fact that you took time out of your day to talk to me and to our community and to share what you've been doing with us. It's so important. And please just keep working hard. And I very much respect the work you're doing and hope that you and the team that is around you can make more discoveries in the next few years.
Thank you, Marcy. It's been a real pleasure. This is just very, very rewarding.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for being on our podcast. And again, hopefully in a couple of years, we'll have you back on with some new discoveries, right?
Exactly.
Let's hope for it, okay?
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good.
Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I am so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.